Our final speaker for session two is Sabina Knight. She's the senior lecturer for the Centre for Remote Health, and Sabina's professional activities are focused on remote, isolated and rural health, in particular Aboriginal primary health care, health inequalities. She's recognised as a leader in remote health nationally and internationally, and I think she's based at Alice Springs, if I'm correct. So, Sabina, you're here today to talk about the social and health impacts of drought on rural and remote communities. So can we make a cool welcome? Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a delight to be here with you, and as a previous daughter of the Black Soil Plains from just down the road, it's just so lovely to be back here. And I'm really keen and pleased that Narrabri and this region is so engaged, and the CRC is so engaged in these broader issues around our future sustainability. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the Gamero people and thank very much for the welcome that we had this morning. And I've grown up on this country, and it is home, the home base, and it's the place that shaped me. I now live in Arundel Land in Central Australia, and I've included a few pictures in my presentation of the country I now live in, the place I now call home. In part, not the least, to distract you from my presentation. Only good pictures or lovely pictures are a way of keeping people engaged, and I hope that you enjoy those. I know that I stand between you and lunch, which is a pretty dangerous position to be in, and so I'll endeavour to move through my presentation. So I'm here to talk about some research or some activity that was undertaken on the looking at the social impacts of drought. This was work that was commissioned by Minister Burke. An expert panel was convened, and it was chaired by Peter Kenny, and it included people who would be known to you: Mal Peters from up the road, Yuwari Alda, Inverell, Professor Danielle Stelic, Barry Wakeland, who's from South Australia, Sue West, and Leslie Young from the CWA. These were the terms of reference of the committee. Well, this is the first time in a review of drought policy that the social and health impacts were considered. And I think that's quite important, and that's already been commented on today, that our understanding of these issues and our understanding of some of the solutions to overcoming these issues clearly include the people. So what we did, or what the project undertook, there was a literature review, which is important to go back and look at what was known. There was some independent research commissioned. There was the Hilda study, some work done by CSIRO and the Bureau of Meteorology, and there was a survey done of primary producers on their attitudes to drought and the support that they were being provided with. Then the panel conducted 25 public consultations around Australia, across rural Australia, and then met with the federal and state departments, ministers, bureaucrats, non-government organisations, and received more than 230 public submissions. So that says to me that this area is clearly very important and topical to people. As we've heard this morning, drought can be experienced in different ways, and the definition's actually quite difficult. You know, where I'm from, I live in a place that's dry. It's always dry. When it rains, we're really thrilled. At the moment, it's bright green, which is quite unusual for us. I've found these definitions quite useful in us thinking about how we're going to go forward into the future, and whilst there's still a lot of work to be done in this, when we talk to people about drought or talk to people about the impact of drought or dryness, it means different things to different people, and it really does depend on where you're from and what you're doing. So if you're in, you know, Central Australia, we have a cattle enterprise like this, dryness is part of the landscape. So turning off stock pretty early on in what looks like a longer or sustained dryness period is normal course of events. the way dryness was experienced in this community over the sustained period over the last 10 years was dramatically impacted on by the increase in price of fuel, which delayed initially turning off stock, and then those increase in oil prices went up. Places that didn't hold debt, that were generationally family owned, for the first time were experiencing significant debt and were experiencing isolation in ways that they had previously not experienced it. Remoteness is the normal in this area, but the ways of dealing with this particular drought changed, and that was because not of the drought or the dryness itself, but because of the other circumstances that were associated with it. And we found this, not this same story, but these combination of stories replicated around the country. So the report, it's about dryness, changing perspectives, have made some observations around values, attitudes and policy, observations around how it impacted on community and families. And I found this quite interesting given that there's quite a few single units involved in agriculture and businesses generally in rural areas, that we still have very much a focus on families. And I think families are important, but we need to recognise that our communities are made up of all sorts of configurations, and policy and support for the future needs to consider those. Also community. We've heard today that our rural communities, our remote communities are made up of different constituents, and again how we experience the social impacts of drought depends on where you stand in that community, what group you belong to or subgroup, and what participation that you would normally have had in the workforce or the economic or cultural vitality of that community. If you were involved as a labourer, then you have a different experience to that as someone who's a property owner. We made some observations around the delivering of human support services, particularly the access to education and training. And there was a disconnect to what people were saying and to what we found was available through other research. So people reported that kids were not being sent to university or support to go to university because it couldn't be afforded. And UNE, as an example, was a university that was reporting who had offered special scholarships to support living allowance and other things to compensate for young kids, young people from drought-affected areas, and they weren't accessing them. So it was hard to work out or to be able to quantify, in fact, whether clearly perception was resulting in changes of participation in tertiary education. But was it that people were unable to notice or hear the support that was being offered because they were so occupied or preoccupied with the business of just surviving from day to day? So planning for drought and dryness really does depend on, you know, where you are and which side of the road or climate experiences that you involve. You know, I, like you, want a strong, vibrant, sustainable rural Australia for the future. And we know that the way that we've heard this morning, that the exceptional circumstances policies and the way that they have been enacted and translated into support has created quite a bit of friction in the community. Certainly the public forums reported strong feelings of division and resentment. On one hand, it was seen as supporting poor practice. On the other hand, it was seen as being inequitable. So there was no easy solution to this. Clearly, stress is undoubtedly being caused by this declaration process and the implementation of those different approaches between and across state and federal jurisdictions. Also, meeting the complex criteria and just being able to complete the paperwork and the bureaucratic processes for which need to be undertaken, the application process, was a disincentive for some people. And this may relate much more to the personal experience of stress and then the ability to be able to take on new knowledge for when you're under sustained stress. I know that we're much closer to the acceptance that in the future that dryness will routinely occur, and that it's not a crisis, it's part of what how we live in Australia. And planning for dryness will now need to be about personal, family, farm and community wellbeing, not just about the business enterprise itself. And we need to develop a place in this planning for where the planning about the individual and the individual asset needs to be protected and enhanced as much as the machinery and the stock or the water or whatever else we use. The most valuable assets, of course, is you, the people. And if you're not well and able, then you're not able to be successful or continue your enterprise. And so the challenge is to design policy to be able to address and support social and physical wellbeing of farm families, rural businesses and communities in ways that won't inhibit their efficiency in their industries. It recognises that intimate connection between the farm as a place to work and as a residence and as part of a family tradition. One of the recommendations that the expert panel made was that it was quite important to, rather than provide crisis frame assistance in times of drought, that there needs to be an ongoing investment in the assistance to support ever-changing communities. So rather than drought counsellors, related financial counsellors, that these programs need to be in place proactively. It is very difficult to be able to learn when you're under, and adapt when you're under pressure. These, in adult learning principles, these are the worst times to be able to take up research, to be able to change practice. The human ability to take on new knowledge and adapt under sustained pressure is very small. The ability to do that in other times is well, this has been replicated in human studies, animal studies, it's not new knowledge. And yet we continue to develop reactive programs and not proactive programs. One of the surveys that was undertaken during this time, the wellbeing survey, and there was a survey of primary producers, these results, controlling for age and income, I found quite interesting. So 12-16% of respondents were less likely to be satisfied with their life as a whole and their standard of living. Up to 20% were satisfied with their health, personal relationships and felt part of the community. So community connectedness was clearly a protective factor here. But people working in drought-affected areas are 21% more likely to feel safe, and yet 8% less satisfied with their spirituality or religion. And people in drought-affected areas were 14% less likely to feel satisfied with their future security. And I wonder if, in fact, education might, there might not be a link between the level of education and people's level of satisfaction, and that hasn't been clarified in that research, and there's certainly room for future research in this area. So people with who were dissatisfied with their future security tended to be in this area. They were over 40, male, had two adults in the household, didn't have children at home, they worked full-time, they had year 11 or 12 education, they were more likely to be married, more likely to earn under $30,000 and have no post-school qualifications. And that raised a hypothesis for me that if you were had a lower level of education or a higher level of education, then they might have had been encouraged to think about how they were going to take care of their future security with other activities, you know, away from home or region work, for example. One of the findings that we found was that there was a consideration of off-farm work in times of drought as being a successful strategy, and certainly that was something that we identified that needed to be promoted. And the benefits of going away from home to work for periods of time were described as being exposed to different practices, different approaches, and a relief from the stress of the managing the business at home. And that this, the translation of these experiences back at home led to improvements and practices and confidence in the way that people were managing their enterprises. That was a surprise to me, and that was also something that I found really encouraging and something that we need to be promoting as a positive and a success, that study towards, for example, are understood to be of worthwhile. And this can be then translated into having periods of time working for and in other settings. You can take on some of those experiences and translate them back into your own enterprise or business or other work back home in the area that you are from in a very positive way. So we know, we've heard this morning, and the work that CSIRO and the Bureau of Meteorology did during the drought review has said that we are going to have an increased risk of severe drought over the next 20 to 30 years compared to the last 100 years. So the more sustained and severe droughts are going to happen more frequently, and these will be exacerbated by increasing temperatures in between. So even if we have years of average rainfall, whatever average rainfall might mean in an area, if those years are hotter, then we're going to have the higher evaporation rates, burning off of feed, etc., for which we'll have a different impact from what we're used to. So planning for dryness needs to be what we do. It's part of how we live in Australia, and the way that we do that is absolutely going to be contextualised to where we are. On the social impact of drought group recommended that there were a whole raft of recommendations, and I've been kind, I've not put those up in the PowerPoint. They're in the reports and they're on the DAF website. But clearly, first and foremost, everyone needs a personal plan, whether they are a farm owner or an enterprise owner, a worker. There needs to be a personal plan, which includes your personal health. There needs to be a business plan. There needs to be a succession plan, and these need to be done in good times, not the hard times. We had plenty of examples of trying to deal with succession planning under times of very high stress, and they inevitably had quite difficult outcomes. And then there needs to be a fallback plan. You know, we always need a fallback plan. What's the secondary plan? And there needs to be a continuing professional development and lifelong learning plan. We all of us live in very changing times. So regardless of our profession, our enterprise, our business, in keeping up to date, in being able to adapt, being engaged in learning in whatever form, whether it's field days, whether it's formal short courses or formal university courses, is just what we do. And creating the opportunities, the access to the delivery of those is the business of everyone, and is important to, this is absolutely the business of the education and the industry groups. Changing the attitudes, or influencing attitudes to embrace this, I think is one of the challenges for us all here at this conference this week. Rural Australia has had quite a strong history of, as we heard this morning, of innovation, of getting involved in R&D, getting involved in the translation of ideas. There's been a fall away from that in the last 10 years, I think, as a result of the impact of drought and dryness, because people have been so occupied with the business of surviving during that time, and there's time for refreshment and reinvigoration and support for this across the areas. And certainly, we need to invest in local skills and services which will best service those who they understand. We heard some great examples of support programs that were developed locally, where they looked at what had happened in other areas, and they had noticed that it might take longer to train up counsellors who are from that area, but once you have them, you've got someone who's going to stay there, who understands the local circumstances and the networks, and who are more likely to be able to reach out. Their activities can be ratcheted up in times of higher need. The most important thing, they're there for the long haul. Similarly with the various professions that we require. We know that if you're able to train people from a rural area, they're more likely to return to a rural area. So there needs to be a matching of what we understand with that evidence in the translation into support for professions right across the service sector. So we can spend a fair bit of time looking in the rearview mirror, we can learn from where we've come, but mostly we need to have an eye on where we're going. And that eye on where we're going is what sort of a world we want to live in, how do we ensure that we are able to have achieved that world, and that that's one which is shared across the community, and that is the whole of the community, not just the bit for which we fit in. Social inclusion is really important as part of this agenda, and we've got quite a bit of work ahead of us in Australia. My work these days is absolutely with those who sit outside of the social inclusion agenda generally, with Aboriginal populations. But not only is it Aboriginal populations who are part of the marginalised, they are a source for, employment innovation for the future, and for those towns who have embraced a social inclusion model, they have higher employment rates, lower crime rates, all of the indicators are improved. And this is one of the areas for which we need to be thinking about as we look to overcome the impacts of drought and dryness and the contraction of community into the future. So it might look like Mount Sonder, it's a big bugger to climb. This is something that I did with my son on Easter Sunday, it was pretty wonderful. But if you take it from the low end and you go slowly and you walk up the top, you actually don't notice the steep climb, and the view from the top is fantastic. But you've got to go down again. And so it is a work in progress. And so the social impacts of drought, as we understand it, and our plan for living in a dry continent is clearly a work not only in progress but work that's ongoing. So changing the language of disadvantage is a huge challenge for us. Using the language of disadvantage had become important in being able to plead the case, but it's alienated us from the mainstream. It's important that we find a new language of engagement to be able to be much more effective in the future. So thank you. It's been a delight to come and talk with you today, and I look forward to talking with you more. Time for questions. I was warned, don't run late for lunch. I haven't.
I've got a couple of minutes. Someone might like to ask a question.
Yes.
Andrew Lewis, Mayor of Bourke.
Thank you, Bert. Talking about various rights on the raising of the Bourke area, is probably a check from off there. A guy here 8 months, 24 months, that he came here for it, knows that people know that's a lot better. And you're prepared to rise, we were 72 months with one range of bills, so how do we do it?
Well, I think that is in fact the question, because we know that if the predictions are right, this is our future. So how do we prepare for dryness as a part of our natural landscape, rather than considering it exceptional circumstances? It's not exceptional. It's going to happen routinely. So that's our challenge for the future. I have not got the answers for that. But in terms of socially, I think there are some things we do need to have in place. So, and I commented on those. So it's not reactive strategies in terms of, you know, the councillors, business development assistance, the various raft of activities and enterprises that have grown out of the last 10 years of drought, but rather being proactive about those in an ongoing way, building up that capacity and expertise so it's not a boom or bust exercise during hard times when people are least likely to be able to take on new knowledge. We need to have much better coordinated, say, mental health services, financial counselling services, thinking about how we're going to deliver education not only in times of dryness, but in the future with the ageing population, well, we are just not going to have the workforce entrance to go into all the professions that we need. So the smart use of technology, people in rural Australia are early adapters, particularly in remote Australia, of technology. How do we get proactive about that so that we are able to deliver education programs from school right through to university, continue professional development, and how do we engage with maintaining social networks and cohesion so that there are challenges to be had, to be met in that, but we need to be proactive about it, not reactive when the times are tough, because that's when we're least likely to be able to make inspired decisions.
Okay, well done. Can we give
Sabina.
Thank you.
You don't often get a chance to do this, but I get it today coming back. I have a fantastic job in Central Australia. I'm an associate professor in remote health practice, and who would have thought a little girl from Marana could do this? But it's because of people like this mob down here. Mentors and inspirations and family friends who support you through your education and your work and your life that we're able to go on and do things. And I think when we live in worlds for which are relatively small, we often forget the power of support and inspiration. So thank you.